And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Mantra Meditation Hour on CITR 101.9 FM with your congenial host, Raghunath.
Welcome to today's show. You're listening to Mantra on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Raghunath. I'll be here with you for the next hour. We have a special show today, the second in the pre-Shakti Fast 2013 series. And today is going to be chock full of interview segments and music from Jai Uttal. We got a chance to chat with him a week or so ago, and the resulting material is enough for a whole show, so we figured we'd do that. Jai grew up in New York City and was musical back then, but in his late teens got interested in Indian music and India itself, and then traveled back and forth studying with different people there, meeting different gurus and spiritual teachers, and eventually meeting his guru and then bringing that music back to the West and integrating it into his own style. He's been releasing music since 1991, so about 22 years, but has been recording, or rather has been performing and leading kirtan for over 30 years. First track we're going to hear is Hari Om from the remix album done by Rara Avisa of the Desert Dwellers, entitled Dal M for Mantra. And then we're just going to flow through the whole show with different music and segments. I don't think that I'm going to break during until very close to the end of the hour. I hope you enjoy. You're listening to Mantra on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Here's Jai Uttal.
Ah. Well, my upbringing was not necessarily a spiritual upbringing. You know, my parents were Jewish, but it was more like cultural, I guess you could say. And it's hard to know when I was a teenager. You know, I was taking psychedelic drugs and I was a hippie, and I started being really, really drawn to Indian music, Indian classical music. And I was drawn to the Hare Krishnas in New York. I listened to them so much. I didn't have the urge to join them, but I was very moved by them, you know. And I was reading all different this and that. So anything spiritual that I could find, I was reading it. But it wasn't necessarily all devotional. But the devotional books were the ones that really made me cry and really grabbed me. And then, excuse me. Then when I went to India at the end of 1970, all those feelings kind of really rose up. And but you know, of course, it's a gradual maturing of understanding and feeling. And you know, after all these years, I'm very aware that I just know very, very little, and that within the years to come, you know, God and my guru will guide me to, you know, an ever deeper and more real and more human and more compassionate and more completely loving devotional path. You know, I'm still really self-centered and self-involved, and I worry about things, and of course, you know, but I also know that's sort of silly.
Like for you in the 70s being in India? And
well, you know, I will never forget that first moment of just getting off the plane in New Delhi. I was 19 years old, so I guess that means it was 1970, I guess the end of 1970. It was like December 1970, and you know I had this incredible, completely immediate feeling that the whole previous part of my life had been exile, and that I was finally had returned home. And I stayed in Old Delhi for, I don't remember, a couple of days, maybe a week. And as weird as Old Delhi is, I was just in bliss, you know. I had something about it. I was just loving it. And then I went to Vrindavan. You know, I had gone to India with a whole agenda, a unique particular guru that I was going to see, who turned out to be in jail, accused of mass murder. Now, he was acquitted, and I'd rather not get into all that, due to the feelings of some friends of mine who are still disciples of that guru. So, you know, I won't go into it, but I was completely cut loose of my agenda, because I didn't want to go there. And I had met Ram Dass in the States, and I was young. I was 19, and I was like a kid, I guess. And I heard that Ram Dass was giving classes in New Delhi at a hotel. So I went there, and the guy at the hotel said Ram Dass had left and that he was now in Vrindavan with his guru. So I went there, and shortly thereafter I met Maharaji. But being in Vrindavan, to me, was like being in heaven. You know, Vrindavan is still an amazing place. But you have to dig a little bit. But in those days, there was no cars, there was no industry, there was very few Westerners, you know, a handful. It was like being in medieval India, and every other house was a temple. It was so amazing. I can't even describe how happy I was. And due to finding that the previous guru, who I had thought was my guru, you know, I guess I had convinced myself he was my guru. I never had met him, but you know how young minds can do that. But due to finding out his situation, I felt like I was not interested in gurus anymore. I was, you know, had done that. But nonetheless, I met Maharaji, and even still, it wasn't like I was immediately saying that this was my new guru. I didn't feel that way. I wasn't interested in that. I didn't even go there. But I did feel that every day there was no place on earth that I wanted to be except at his feet. And, you know, in Maharaj's temples, there was 24-hour constant chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, Maha Mantra, and it was so beautiful. You know, the singers that they had in 1971, I mean, of course, there's still beautiful singers in this world, but, you know, I can't even describe the beauty. And as is the case everywhere in India, they had the singers broadcast out of loudspeakers. You know, we know, anyone who's been to India knows that kind of beautiful and slightly odd phenomena. But in this case, the kirtan was so beautiful that, you know, I would just sit there and I sit at my guru's feet, and he never gave lectures, he never gave discourses, but we would just bathe in the beauty of the name as it was just being sung. And then they would turn off the loudspeakers at different times during the day. The singing still was going on, but the microphones were off. And then Maharaji would tell us, meaning most of the Westerners, to go over there, like in that side of the courtyard, and sit and sing kirtan. He didn't tell us which songs to sing. He didn't tell us how to do it. He just told us to do it. And we did.
Gopala, 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 Gopala. Shri Krishna Govind Hare Murari, He Nata Narayana Vasudeva, He Nata Narayana Vasudeva, He Nata Narayana Vasudeva. Gopala, 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 He Gopala, 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 Gopala. Shri Krishna Gauri.
What was it like with the time that you spent with the Baals in India?
That experience was another one of the highlights of my life. Both just on every level, you know, musically, spiritually, just personally, just, you know, I had been listening to the Bells of Bengal albums since I was a teenager, and you know, and I just kind of, as much as I was able, there wasn't a lot of information available, but I was following them and trying to understand them and reading about them. You know, I've always also been a Bob Dylan fan, like a huge Bob Dylan fan, and his album John Wesley Harding has two bowels on the cover, and so a friend of mine and myself decided that we were going to go search for them. And it was 1974. My guru had just left his body. And we went to a town called Shantiniketan in West Bengal, or Shantiniketan, I guess is how you say it, which was a town that was founded by Rabindranath Tagore, a great Bengali poet and humanist and philosopher, amazing guy. So we went there and we searched for the bells, and for a while we didn't know where to find them, and you know, it's a long, long story, but finally saw this old man on the street. You know, he was wearing patchwork clothes, and he had a, what did they call the little doogie drum attached to his belt. It's kind of like the baya of a set of tablas, and he had an ektar in his right hand, and he had a brightly colored turban on, and he had bells on his ankles, and he was just walking down the street. And he wasn't, you know, he couldn't sing very well, but he was singing with a lot of feeling, a lot of emotions. And so we followed him from a bit of a distance just to see where he was going. You know, we were young. We were, 22 or 23 or something like that. And he was going to this little mela, this little festival on the outskirts of the village. Nothing huge or grand, a little stage with lots of Christmas lights scattered around. And a band of about 30 people on stage, which again reminds me of what I try to do at Bhakti Fest. And it was grandmas, kids, wives, husbands, uncles, cousins, everybody was on stage. And there was one dangling microphone, and the lead singers, you know, they took turns singing. And oh, it was so beautiful. It was like, oh, you know, it was just so beautiful. Talk about passionate devotional singing. And then afterwards I tried to chat with some of the singers, and I saw, lo and behold, one of them, the guy who I liked the most in his singing, was the one from Bob Dylan's album cover. Wow. Lakshman Das Bawal. And the funniest thing was, like, he knew very few words in English. I knew nothing in Bengali, but what he kept saying to me is, "Do you have LSD?" I said, "No, I don't." But he introduced me to a guy, I don't know if he was a relative or just a friend, but another Bal named Baijanath Das Bal. And Baijanath became our teacher. And he would come to our house three or four times every week. We had a little house in West Bengal in the desert, kind of. It was a sort of a deserty area. And he would come and teach me and my friend Gangadhar, teach us songs and teach us instruments. And the problem was that we didn't know any Bengali and he didn't know any English. But our next door neighbor, actually, who was also the landlord of the house, was an artist, beautiful man named Kiran Sinha. And he was a very well-known artist in India. He had, Indira Gandhi had been his patron, and he was very, you know, super successful in the world. And then he retreated. He said he couldn't stand the commercial existence of an artist, and he retreated to this town in West Bengal with his wife, who was Swedish, I think Swedish. Anyway, he spoke perfect English, so he became our translator for the Bal songs, and then gradually my house there became known to all the Bals of the area, and they would all, because they're pretty itinerant, you know, and they would all, you know, every day a different group of Bal singers would come over and sing with us, for us, ask for money, ask for food, sing more. You know, some of them felt like really holy men. Some of them felt like, oh, you keep track of your wallet, you know. but all of them sang this beautiful, beautiful music. And the Bal music is different. It's different from any other music I've heard of. You know, it's Bengali, so it's similar to Bengali kirtan in some ways, some of the melodies, but it's unique. And they're Now, they don't see God as external. They see God as internal, but as being the form of Krishna inside. Although some of them are Sufi-oriented and some of them are more tantric-oriented. So it's like a real kind of a mixed up, beautiful mishmash of devotional life. And they sing and they dance, and they're very guru-oriented as well.
Related to Vrindavan. It's called The Path of a Thousand Tears. Is that right?
Did I say a thousand tears or did I say 1,008 tears?
1,008, maybe? I don't know.
I have to double check my own thing. It was called Parikrama.
Right. Parikrama. How did that come to be?
Well, back in those days and many subsequent visits to Vrindavan, I would walk every morning on this path called Parikrama. Parikrama, I guess, literally just means going around, I guess, the literal meaning. It's a path that goes around the village of Vrindavan. And people walk on this path barefoot as a devotional worship of Lord Krishna. And you know, I've heard so many different ideas about what it actually means. So I don't know literally, but the thing that that always felt beautiful to me is that people would describe it as we were walking around Krishna's body. And, you know, everyone who walks the path, people don't chat. I mean, I guess some people chat, you know, when I make a complete generalization, but mostly everyone who's walking around is chanting one thing or another. And on the path, you see so many like amazing things like that might not seem so amazing in the telling, but in the experience, it was so amazing. An old man sitting under a tree, you know, reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, chanting. Another, you know, field of peacocks walking by. Other, you know, the beautiful saris of the ladies, you know, walking in the path in the morning. So many little ashrams. You pass so many ashrams and hear the chanting and see the people chanting and they're doing the devotional practices and services. And, you know, it never was mundane. It was completely transcendental every single time. And sometime in the 80s, I don't remember which trip it was, I hurt my foot. And it became very difficult to walk around barefoot. And so I did it a couple times with shoes on, but that just felt so weird. even though, you know, now people they got trucks on Parikrama. It's really so disturbing. But anyway, you know, those experiences of walking around the village, walking around that path were so moving to me and so, you know, deeply imprinted into my heart. So that's why I named that the song that. You know, and there's other Parikrams. There's Govardhan Parikram, which is a bigger walk, and there's a whole Braj Parikram, which walks around all the areas. I didn't do that, though. But I walked the Vrindavan Parikram tons and tons of times.
That into the experience in the West, be it releasing albums or large kirtan festivals that have been popping up over the past few years?
In some ways it's completely different and in some ways it's completely the same. As far as making albums, you know, I'm a musician and an artist and I love the process in the studio of recording. It's also very difficult. It's also constantly challenging. You know, throws me right back on where am I coming from, you know, or what is my motivation, how clear is my heart. But I love creating beautiful music, and particularly, I mean, exclusively, I'll say, beautiful music as an offering to God. And I pray that in doing so, it heals my heart, and I pray that in receiving it, other people's hearts are lifted and brought toward that, toward the Lord, you know? But I don't know if that happens, and I can't really control whether that happens, because I'm just, you know, hanging on for dear life myself. At the festivals, you know, in India, when we sing kirtan, you're singing kirtan, your eyes are closed, and then you open your eyes and you see the deity, right? You see the temple, or you see your guru, or you see, you know, the divine ones. Then when we're in the West and we're singing kirtan, and your eyes are closed, and you open your clothes. Yeah, I mean, then you open your eyes. You see all the people looking at you. And, you know, part of that is really beautiful. You see this beautiful, all these beautiful shining faces praying to God and singing from their hearts. But you also see a zillion people with their projections and with their, like, adoring the wrong aspect. And it can be also distracting. But, you know, I often sing this prayer that Tulsidas wrote, where he says, I see Sita and Rama in every molecule of creation, in every face that I see, in everything of the universe, and I bow to Sita and Rama in everything of manifested creation. So I try to remember that when I look out at the crowds and I see people. I try to remember that, wait a second, these are all, you know, filled with, every molecule is filled with Hari, is Hari, is God. You know, it's created by and inhabited by and expressing of God. And I try to remember that while I'm singing. I also try to have a lot of people on stage with me, because then I feel like I'm just part of a village. Sometimes at Bhakti Fest, they have such a big stage, and I invite everybody I love and know up to stage to join with me. Some of them are great musicians, and some of them maybe aren't. But we create a village on stage, and then I look around me, and I see everyone singing God's name from such a beautiful, beautiful place of spirit and passion. And then it's really uplifting for me. So it's mixed up, you know, it's mixed up. There's different aspects of it. There's so much in the West also that, you know, on one side, a lot of times in kirtan in India, people are kind of blasé about it. And that's also really cool, because it's so much a part of their life that they don't rev themselves up, they just do it. But in the West, there's also now, you know, people are so passionate about it, and that's going to be really inspiring. There's so many levels, right? If you get 1,000 people together, or at Bhakti Fest, like 4,000 or 5,000 people together singing kirtan, every single person is coming from a bit of a different place. And I try to remind people not to tell them what they should be feeling, but to ask themselves why they're doing it, and to be honest and know that any answer that comes from honesty is it's okay. If they're doing it, wherever they're coming from, it's okay if they're real about it and honest about it, because God's name is going to save us all in the end anyways. But it's good to be real about it, you know. So anyway, I just try to ask people to take a moment of, you know, just checking in.
Rang Ramarama Shring Sita Swaha Rang Ramarama Shring Sita Swaha
I see Nubia walking back and forth. I wanted to talk just for a second about the aspect of dance. I saw you at Prana Fest. Was she dancing on stage with you?
Yeah.
What does that add to the experience, to the kirtan experience in an environment like that?
When I see Nubia dancing, my spirits are lifted, my heart is lifted, my song comes out more full, more with more, you know, feeling and more love. And Nubia teaches yoga, and she teaches dance, and I think your students are really lucky. there's a lot, when you go to these festivals, there's a lot of different kind of dancing. Dancing while singing kirtan is super beautiful because people like to move, you know, when their heart is expanding, some people like to really move their bodies. And it's really uplifting and it's really great. Nubia, though, but, you know, her dancing comes completely from her soul and her heart and also from her, you know, consistent training in Indian classical dance. Even when she's not exactly doing an Indian classical dance performance, you know, her the whole consciousness of worship through dance is coming through. So, you know, I'm totally biased and... but there you go. But, you know, in India, you go to some places and you see the whole room or the whole courtyard or whatever it is, everybody's dancing while they're singing, and it's so unselfconscious and so, like, amazing. And, you know, not every... In some places in India, people are singing kirtan and they're all sitting, and that's just a different kind of vibe. But that unselfconsciousness, I have to confess that I am completely self-conscious when I dance. And I hope and pray that sometime in my life I'll be able to get past that, you know. But when it's an unselfconscious, complete expression of the body in devotion, you know, gosh, you see all the pictures of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they're all dancing, and Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna from Calcutta, you know, always dancing.
Kirtan camps that you have been doing over the past 10 years or so, you have a winter and a summer one. What are those like, and how did that come about?
Well, they are so beautiful, but I'll first tell you how they came about. My wife, Nubia, she's a Brazilian yogini. She's an incredible person. You know, so one day I was coming back from some long trip, touring, and she said, "Oh man, Jai, you look so tired. You're so tired." And you came back and really, you know, you made so much money for other people. Why don't we try to do something ourselves? Anyway, I said, of course, no, that wouldn't work. Nobody would come. But Nubia said, well, let's try it. And then other people signed up. And then my next panic attack was, what was I going to say to them? What was I supposed to teach them? I didn't know anything. Yeah, I mean, I felt like I didn't know anything. And was just so much struggling just to stay on this path myself, you know. Gosh, it's so big. But anyway, what I realized very soon was that, yes, I had a lot to share, but not only that, everyone who came to Kirtan Camp had a lot to share. And in the sharing, we all uplifted each other's hearts so much. And we sing a lot, and we also share a lot of musical... you know, music, Indian music scales, harmonium, tabla, not really tabla technique, but rhythms. And I also feel that, you know, if there's one thing I can share with people is that for people who are drawn to kirtan and who are drawn to devotional life, there's absolutely nothing stopping them from singing kirtan. You know, people say, I don't have a good voice, or I don't have, I don't play an instrument, or I don't have spiritual feelings, or, you know, all this stuff that people worry about. And so we teach a couple of musical skills, and we teach a couple of things, but it's really just to convince people that, wait a second, you actually don't need anything except a heart that longs for God. And everyone's got that. you know, some people aren't quite ready to dive into that, and they're not the people who come to Kirtan Camp, and that's okay. But I would say that if there's a theme or a gift that I want to share with people who come to Kirtan Camp, that's it. That the personal practice of bhakti, of singing, of you know, there's always a lot of questions, philosophical questions and stuff, and I say, oh, that's a beautiful research topic. Why don't you research that and come back to us and teach us? But the main thing is you can sing. You know, you don't need any kind of voice, good or bad. I mean, good or bad, those are like, in this sphere, those are irrelevant concepts. You don't need a spiritual feeling. You need feelings, and everyone has feelings. And then let God turn the feelings into what we would call spiritual feelings. God, that's God's job, you know. You don't need to play an instrument. You know that. You travel around India, you see zillions of people singing. They don't play anything. And we can begin to learn an instrument, you know, in baby steps. Everyone can learn simple things on an instrument if they want. And, you know, all that stuff. And people say, I sing and my voice sounds so weak. And I say, oh, God bless you. You know, that strength is so overrated. My music teacher, Ali Akbar Khan, so often said to us, God doesn't care about strong. God, when you sound weak, God comes running to you. You know, something like that. And I just said, well, sing from the weakest place you can find. Sing from, because really, we are all so completely dependent on God. We forget that because it's our Western culture doesn't want us to think like that. You know, we're supposed to be strong, self-sufficient people, but we're not.
Sitara.
Well, the inspiration was really from my son, who has just turned 8. Well, you know, from the day that he was born, no, that's not true. From the day Nubia got pregnant, we were singing to him. And we were singing to him inside her belly, and we were singing to him and talking to him and singing kirtan to him. And then he's born, and then I'm singing kirtan to him and singing kirtan to him. Then he gets a little older, and I'm telling stories to him and singing kirtan to him, and he's just like so, you know, into it. And then gradually, he began to sing with me. And then gradually, you know, I would sing kirtan with some of his friends, and then at his preschool, I would go and sing kirtan and tell stories. And then we had a couple of, you know, local events, donation only events, and with all the kids. And gradually, that's developed, and it was, you know, pure joy, just pure joy to sing kirtan and tell stories with the kids. And so, you know, once again, I really wanted to make an album for the kids and with the kids, and it took a couple of years for it to manifest. But it's, you know, I'm singing, and Ben, who works with me, is co-producing, and another grown-up, a couple of grown-ups are singing. But most of the chanting is done by the kids, and you know, both the calling and the responding. And there's a couple of stars. My son, of course, I'm such a proud, biased father. My son is one of the stars, and the two other stars, you know, Gauravani, right? His two daughters are also the stars of the album. And there's some segments in English and English singing, and then a lot of kirtans. And it's so cute. It's just so cute. And I feel like it's, in a sense, it's one of the most best things I've ever done because, you know, I guess I first started hearing kirtan when I was a teenager. But knowing the joy of singing these names from such an early age, you know, it's like I couldn't see a better service to do in the world. I mean, my little boy, you know, he's a wild kid, he's a total boy, you know, he does everything a boy does, and he loves doing japa. Now that's just like so amazing to me. He's 8 years and 1 month, and he loves doing japa. He loves everything else that all the other little boys love, you know, and he loves doing japa. And so I feel like the Kirtan Kids album is just putting energy in that direction.
Last album that you put out, Queen of Hearts, is about Radharani, or at least the name. How did that come about as well, that you wanted to make an album about Radha?
Yeah, well, the album is dedicated to Radharani, for sure. And all the songs are about Radha and Krishna. I mean, about, you know what I mean, mantras, kirtan mantras invoking Radha and Krishna. Which are the kirtans that I've been singing for, gosh, I started singing kirtan before I ever went to India, like in the 60s. And of course, in different phases of my life, I've sung different kirtans, but mostly they've been Radha Krishna kirtans and Sitaram Hanuman kirtans. Not exclusively, but mostly. And so I wanted to do a whole album of these songs. And you know, then I think in, you know, the bhakti movement, what a funny yet beautiful phenomena. But I find that, well, many of the philosophical aspects of devotional path have become Americanized. And, you know, I mean, how do I say this? It's just great. There's really nothing negative to say about people singing God's name. And yet, I think we forget the American consciousness is so will and ego oriented, and self experience oriented, you know, that we forget about grace, and we forget about service, and we forget about what I consider to be the reality that any devotional, real devotional feelings that we are able in this life to experience come from God. They don't come from us. They don't come from our achievements. They don't come from the intensity of our practices. And who distributes these devotional feelings, you know, is Radharani. And also I would say on my other hand, I would say Lord Hanuman. You know, the devotee. Of course, they're different. Their whole manifestations are different. But yet, they embody complete devotion. And they're the ones who give us our little droplets of devotion. And so I'm just begging for that, a little bit of that grace. And I would like for people to realize that, I mean, going to a huge party where everyone's singing kirtan and you feel blissed out is so great. Right, there's nothing on earth that I could say that is negative about that. And yet, really, when we start doing our devotional practices for others, and thus for God Himself, or God herself, and not for our own like blissful experiences, then the path of bhakti begins to have a different and a much, 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 much bigger meaning. And I just, you know, somehow want to help to convey that. And so I devoted that album to Radha and called her Queen of Hearts and said that what little bits, we're just so, you know, we're just all babies on this path. And what teensy little taste of devotion that we have comes from grace and grace alone. And I don't know. I don't know if that answers the question. But that's what I was thinking.
You listen to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. The show's called Mantra. And that was Jai Uttal. Some interview segments and music from him. That pretty much caps it. I've got one more song to go, but I'll give you a heads up on what we heard. In terms of music, we heard Hari Om from Dial M for Mantra, which was an album remixed by Rara Avis of the Desert Dwellers. That's from 2007. We heard Gopala Lullaby from Loveland Music for Dreaming and Awakening by Jai Uttal and Ben Lineback from 2007 or so. Lake of Exploits from Beggars and Saints from 1995, which was inspired by the Bowels of Bengal, which we heard about earlier in the interview. Sri Krishna Govinda, also from Dial M for Mantra. Bajrangi from Nectar, which I believe was a live album from 2001. And Shakyamuni Prayer, which also featured Jai's wife Nubia, from the release Pranayama from 2005. Sitaram from Nectar also. Shambolo, which you're currently listening to in the background, from Bhakti Bazaar, from Ben Lineback and Jai Uttal from 2010. Also, we heard a couple of tracks in the background from Music for Yoga from 2004, and also the title track Beggars and Saints from 1995 from that album. Thanks for tuning in today. I have to give a big thanks to Jai Uttal for taking the time out to do this interview a week or so ago. He's going to be appearing at Shakti Fest, which is coming up, I think it starts tomorrow. And that's in Joshua Tree, California. You can have a look at the Bhakti Fest website, bhaktifest.com, for information about that 3-day Kirtan festival. Jai will also be appearing at Bhakti Fest later in the year in September in the same place in California. Last track is going to be also from Nectar, the Radha remix by Ben Lineback. Thanks for tuning in today. On the internet, you can check out all the previous episodes of Mantra Radio by going to mantraradio.co. You can also send feedback through the website, and on Facebook as well, you can find us as Mantra Radio. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Take care of yourself till then. Namaste.